as we are all too well aware, this time of year, the secular holidays begin to consume the secular world. Halloween barely arrives when Xmas bells start ringing, and the banner is raised from the majority of establishments across the land, especially the commercial ones, which claim that without this year-end hoopla, they would not survive another year financially. Human beings have by nature a desire to observe celebrations. It's an instinctive thing within each of us. So Yahweh made us that way, and it becomes our sacred duty then to honor those right celebrations that we find in Yahweh's Word. And so that's what we do. We have just come off the last of the annual Moedim, and now we wait for another 6 months maybe, till the next spring observances come. Yahweh's appointed times are anything but ancient, obsolete ritual. That's what you're going to hear, though, from many people that, hey, you know, those things are dead and gone, and we're no longer for us today. Yet we know that they're alive. We know just by observing them that there's so much blessing and so much power in them to influence our lives. And they have a transcendent purpose, unlike man's holidays that come and go, and that's the end of it. They pass a day or two of celebration, and that's it. People then are on to the next one. What's next? If only we'd understand the power of Yahweh's days, they're like roadmaps. The annual Moedim give us a way to find His will and His salvation, both in the lessons and in the execution of these days. The Bible is revealed on many levels, as we know. And the key is to advance from one level to another, and in so doing, learn and further understand Yahweh's mind. And that's really what we study the Bible for. If you have no interest in Bible study, you have no interest in understanding Yahweh, because that's what we do it for. Every Sabbath, we have Bible study before the service, and we learn by going through each book of the Bible and try to ferret out the very essence of what Yahweh's telling us in these things. So that's why we do it. We want to know His will. Our worship is necessarily Yahweh-centered. That's something unique in this world. That's something unique among the religions of this world, because so much of worship that we see today is about the worshiper and not Yahweh. Excuse me. The wrong approach to worship is to please the worshiper. And we think about historically how that happened when Aaron made the golden calf to please the people, to please them in their worship. When Jeroboam held a feast separate from Yahweh, a month later tried to get people to come to his feast. True worshipers are distinguished by the desire to give to Yahweh exactly what He expects, meaning acting on His will, not our own. One of the greatest patriarchs in Scripture who exemplifies this desire of man to please and understand Yahweh is typifying our Savior Himself. We know this man better than, at least by name, better than any other, that maybe Yahweh's name itself. And the true character of this man is basically reflective of Yahshua. And that's what I want to talk about today. Reflective of Yahshua, this man that is known by the same name, Yahshua, the son of Nun. In Hebrew, Nun means perpetuity, or Nun. There's two different ways I guess you can pronounce it. Perpetuity, doesn't that sound very apropos if he's going to be a very symbol of Yahshua? His life, perpetual. This man led Israel over the Jordan, kind of in the same way that Israel went across the Red Sea. They threw some rocks in the water. The water balled up, it said, made a dam, basically, and Israel was able to cross the Jordan. Very many symbols in what we see there. But today I want to look at this extraordinary individual, this follower of Yahweh, and what his life can teach us about Yahweh and about being one of his. Before we get into it, though, we need to set the stage. It's very important we understand the account. Moses leads Israel out of Egypt. The expressed purpose to Pharaoh is to keep a feast in the wilderness. A feast in the wilderness, Exodus 3:18. That's what Yahweh wanted Israel to leave for. Ultimately, more than that, of course, but that's what the express purpose was at this point. So here we have a man who has done his job and brought the people out of the sin of Egypt. So he miraculously saves Israel through the miracle of the Red Sea. And they're overjoyed to be free at last. Free of bondage. But the joy is relatively short-lived. Because Israel then turns inward, as typically happens with we, the people. We turn inward. Instead of outward to Yahweh, we start looking within. We start looking at our condition. We start thinking, you know, I could have it better, and we start complaining. Up until this time, their worship was directed at Yahweh. Yahweh was everything. I mean, he was their salvation coming out of Egypt. There's so many miracles he brought to them. But now they start looking a different direction, which is typical. The same sun that melts the wax hardens the clay. These people are becoming hard in their hearts. As Israel considered their plight, they listened to their inner selfish desires and their motives and their instincts. Exodus 16:1-3. This is one of the series of times Israel lodged complaints with Moses. They took their journey, it says, from Elim, and all the congregation of the children of Israel came into the wilderness of Sin. I find that a very interesting word. I don't think it means the same thing that we know about sin, but that's very apropos, which is between Elim and Sinai on the 15th day of the seventh month, after their departing out of the land of Egypt. Verse 2, and the whole congregation of the children of Israel murmured against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. Why? They were the targets. I mean, you know, it's their fault. They got us out of slavery, but yet now we're not happy because of our circumstance. And the children of Israel said unto them, would that we had died by the hand of Yahweh in the land of Egypt. That's better than this. When we sat by the flesh pots and when we did eat bread to the full. For you have brought us forth into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger. So now they're complaining to Moses. You know, something about complaining, something about attitude can affect others. Did you know Moses also complained? Oh yeah, Moses complained too. And no doubt, their complaining didn't help him either. Moses returned unto Yahweh and said, Yahweh, wherefore have you so evil entreated this people? Why is it that you have sent me? And Moses is even having his own doubts. You don't think your attitude can affect others? Oh my goodness. Anybody who's married, has a grouchy wife, knows, or husband, knows that they can set you off in the wrong mood just like that. Verse 23, for since I came to Pharaoh to speak in your name, he has done evil to this people, neither have you delivered your people at all. Now Moses complaining to Yahweh. You haven't acted. You haven't done anything. But when it came to grumbling, Israel took the grand prize. Oh my goodness. First they were thirsty, didn't have water. Yahweh makes water come out of a rock. Then they're hungry. He makes food fall from the sky. Then they griped about having to eat it every day. We all eat it every day, same old stuff. Manna, 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 manna. Then they got problems ahead of them. They looked at the Canaanites. Oh my goodness, how are we ever going to conquer this land? These people, there's so many of them. Then they started questioning Moses' authority. What right do you have to bring us out here and doing this to us? And then they complained that Moses caused many of their deaths, not realizing it was themselves that did this. Being difficult and self-focused was Israel's favorite spectator sport. And now before we castigate them, we must ask, are we any different? What about us? Do we complain a lot? Do you think that Yahweh's chosen don't ever complain that they don't look back to the sin that they left and perhaps maybe yearn for the good old days? I hope not, but I'm sure it happens. Do they ever at times secretly wish they were more like everyone else in the culture, you know? Just go along with the flow. No problems. They think everybody has problems, but it looks like they don't have at least the same problems they have. Wouldn't it be nice to make some overtime money and not have to work and have to take off Sabbath and not get the benefits? Or as young people, maybe have some sport activity on Friday nights. You can't do that when you keep the Sabbath. You know, I kind of wish I could. How come I can't do that? Maybe the kids wonder. Why go through all the hassle preparing for Yahweh's feast and then come back and have to catch up on everything? Here it is, Yahweh's will, brethren. We're looking at Yahweh's will, and why are we complaining about these things? Don't you realize that He's setting you up for something grand somewhere down the line in the future? To be an actual kingly, priestly group of people? What about wishing they didn't have to consult the Bible all the time, wondering, can I do this, can I do that? Explain their beliefs to relatives and friends all the time. How much easier just to be a resident of Egypt. You don't have to explain anything. You just go with the flow. In Egypt, all you have is the wonderful produce varieties like we had the leeks and the melons. And here we're out here eating this manna every day. I want something to taste different. I want some meat. In Egypt, you don't have to defend your faith. You just go along with everybody else. They understand. I hope this isn't you. Because if it is, you've got a long row to hoe. Israel wished they could go back to Egypt. Forget this wilderness stuff, Moses. You can have it. I hate living the life of a nomad in tents. It's uncomfortable. I don't have bathroom facilities. I want my house back, my comforts. Boy, how quickly they forget. Can you imagine? They want to go back to being slaves, to be enslaved by people. I've been deprived of the good things. Moses, take me back. The life of a believer is a series of trials and tests, brethren. You think you have it? You're the only one that has those problems? Everybody does. Are you willing to give up just some of what this life offers for something a whole lot better? In a heartbeat, you say, okay, then what about things like giving to Yahweh? What's His, like 10% of the income? That's minimal. Someday we're going to have to give up everything. If we can't give up 10%, how can we give up everything? We won't. We won't do it. As Richard Young Mueller says, I can't do it. You have to give it all up for Yahweh. That's just a lesson. We sacrifice every day in different ways. This is just one of the ways. We have to learn to sacrifice for the kingdom. If you can't give it back to Him what's already His, how can you give up your all? To walk away from all our possessions. No doubt that very thing will be a test maybe one day for all of us. Just be able to walk away. How many people couldn't do that? 99.9%, I'd say, of the people out in the world couldn't do that. They're going to fight for everything they have. That's what Israel had to do. Give it all up. Go. Go out in the wilderness. Give it all up. All the pleasures and the easy things of life. And go out and live as nomads. In truth, you know, what we keep for ourselves isn't ours anyway, no matter what. Yahweh has it all, even our lives. Yahweh says, put me first and watch the storehouse of heaven open up. He didn't mean necessarily right then. He means by and by, eventually. In due time, you're going to get blessings untold. Of all their shortcomings, Israel's biggest problem was the same ones we share. They didn't trust Yahweh. They didn't have faith that He'd protect them. They didn't trust Him to keep His promise. Each doubt we have, even the small ones, reflect a lack of faith too. Where's our faith? Do we really have faith to go out and do it? Do what He says and excuse me, take whatever consequences may be for a better prize, for something better, for a crown one day. Besides that, they had spiritual Alzheimer's. Their memories were so short they couldn't remember what Yahweh had done for them last week. Reminds me of the elderly man who wanted to improve his recall. So he decided he's going to take a memory course. Memory course built on association. You know, you think of one thing and that leads you to remember something else that's connected. So he took the course. His friend came along and said, "Boy, where you been these last few weeks?" "Well, I've been taking a memory course, Sam." "Really? Oh, yeah, it's built on association. You know, one thing leads to another, and you can remember things that way." "Oh, really? What was the name of that course?" "What's that flower, that long-stem flower, has lots of colors and has little thorns on it?" "Oh, you mean a rose?" "Yeah, rose. Hey, Rose, what was the name of that course I took?" Israel had short memories. Selective recall. And when they grumbled against Moses, they were actually griping to Yahweh. Think about it. Think about it. Moses was just carrying out Yahweh's plan, and they're angry with Moses. So that, in essence, they're angry with Yahweh. 1 Corinthians 10:10. "Neither murmur you, as some of them also murmured, and were destroyed of the destroyer." Philippians 2:14 tells us, "Do all things without murmurings and disputings." Amid all of Israel's pessimism and complaining, we have a ray of light. There was one man who outshined. I mean, he walked into a room and you just felt a difference. His faith was strong. Strong enough to carry an entire nation to the promised deliverance. He's symbolic of Yahshua the Messiah, even sharing the same name. The Israelite Joshua was extraordinary. Extraordinary human being. A saint of saints. Unshakable at his convictions, like the great men of Yahweh always were. Completely faithful. Utterly trusting of Yahweh. So let's take a look. Excuse me. Of all the adults among the perhaps 2.5 million people, Israelites who came out of Egypt, only two would be allowed into the promised land. Imagine that. Plus the ones under 20, but I'm talking about adults. Only two. A man named Joshua and Caleb. What an honor. And it was granted to them because of their complete reliance and faith in Yahweh. They looked at the obstacles and didn't see them. They saw what they could overcome. We first see this remarkable man in Exodus chapter 17. "Then came Amalek and fought with Israel in Rephidim. And Moses said unto Joshua, 'Choose out men and go out and fight with Amalek. Tomorrow I will stand at the top of the hill with the rod of Elohim in my hand.'" Do you remember the account? When his arms were up, they were victorious. When he got tired, his arm went down, Israel started to lose. So Joshua did that, and he attacked them. When his hands got heavy, they took a stone and put it under him, and he sat thereon, and Aaron and Hur stayed up his hands, the one on the one side, the one on the other, and his hands were steady until the going down of the sun. So Joshua, in verse 13, discomfited Amalek and his people with the edge of the sword. Now, notice a couple things here. Moses said, "Joshua, you're going to lead the people." Interesting how it doesn't seem like he had any beef about it. Over and again, we see that the qualities he had were exactly the things that Yahweh was looking for. Faith, conviction, and he was also very patient. When it all seems hopeless, Yahweh comes through. We have to learn patience sometimes. Things aren't going well the way we think. So, I'm sure we can all attest to the many times in our lives when we face these same things that Israel did and look to a man named Joshua or Yahshua. We can attest to the same things and get the strength we need by these men. As soon as we start to complain, the enemy enters. He's always just waiting for an opening, just standing there like outside the door, waiting. We are most vulnerable when we are discouraged and disheartened. So Moses picks out this man, Joshua, and tells him to assemble an immediate fighting force. Who was he? What special training did he have? What college of the military did he go to? Just another Israelite slave from Egypt. No special military training. It was no easy assignment. For all he knew, he could end up like the Russians of Stalingrad in World War II, just getting wiped out by the Germans. 1.1 million people just wiped out. One battle. Could have happened to him. But the amazing thing is his immediate and positive response to the request. He's going to go. He's going to fight. Okay. Just show me where to go. We'll take Israel into it. There wasn't any, let me think about that for a while. You see, I'm not a general. I've never fought in a war. I don't know these people or how to go about fighting them. You might try asking someone else who has at least had some military experience. Moses? You know, even Moses tried to argue his way out of appearing before Pharaoh. But not Joshua. No excuses. This is an important attribute of a remarkable example of what Yahweh's looking for. That's the kind of faith Yahweh wants. He says, go. You say, okay, tell me when. Think about his past. You know, his forefathers were slaves for 400 years in Egypt. You know what it's like being a slave? I'm sure his dad sat him down one day and said, okay, now that you're an adult, you're going to have to go be a slave with the adults. Imagine him telling him, now, you're old enough, so here's some advice. Never stand idle for a minute. Always be moving, always working. From sun up to sundown, you're a slave. Your Egyptian taskmasters detest when you're standing around doing nothing. And never look at one in the eye, or you'll get a whip on the back. If you feel sick or hungry, just keep going. Keep it to yourself. If you want to survive, keep moving. Just do your task. Stay alive. That's your future. Wonderful being a slave. Ah, let's go back to Egypt. Think about it. What hope do you have? Out of this abject misery rises a paragon of greatness that even us with all our advantages could never attain to. We'd be hard-pressed to emulate. And I submit that our faith looks anemic in comparison. It really does. Mark chapter 9, verse 14, if you got your glasses on. We find an example of faith without limits. Or faith with limits, you might say. Joshua was completely devoted. But when Joshua came, he saw a great multitude about him and the scribes questioning with them. And straightway all the people, when they beheld him, were greatly amazed and running to him, saluted him. And he asked the scribes, what question you with them? And one of the multitude answered, said, teacher, I have brought unto you my son, which has a dumb spirit. And wheresoever he taketh them, he teareth him, and he foameth, and he gnashes with his teeth, and wastes away. And I spake to your disciples that they should cast him out. But they couldn't do it. And he answered them and said, O faithful generation, how long shall I be with you? How long shall I bear with you? Bring him unto me. This guy had a problem. His little boy, for most of his life, if not all of his life, was possessed by a spirit. Like an epileptic seizure is really what he apparently had. He said, how long has he had it? And he says, oh, since he was a child. And oftentimes he casts him into the fire and into the waters to destroy him. But if you can do anything, have compassion on us and help us. If you can do anything, help us, Joshua. And straightway the father of the child cried out and said with tears, Master, I believe. Help you my unbelief. When Joshua saw that the people came running together, he rebuked the foul spirit and saying unto him, you dumb and deaf spirit, I charge you, come out of him and enter no more into him. And the spirit cried and ran him sore and came out of him, and he was as one dead. Inasmuch as they said, well, now the boy's dead. Joshua says, no, he isn't. Took him by the hand, lifted him up, and he arose. And when he was come into the house, his disciples asked him privately, how come we couldn't do that? How come we couldn't cast the spirit out? And he said unto them, this kind comes out but by nothing but prayer and fasting. Prayer and fasting. What brings them out? Joshua said in verse 23, if you can believe, all things are possible to him that believes. And straightway the father child cried out and said with tears, Master, I believe, help you my unbelief. And that's what he did. He helped his unbelief. Sometimes we have to ask for faith. Sometimes we have to ask for belief, for strength. Sometimes we're just too weak. The enemy, Amalek, came from Israel's distant past. Jacob's twin brother, Esau. He's our old nature, brethren. Amalek is our old self. It rears its head whenever we're in a state of stress. It wars with us, and it wars with Yahweh. And it causes us to say things we wish we had not said, to do things we wish we had not done. It gives us doubts. It tries our faith. Amalek is a tool of the adversary, and it's the old nature of each of us. In Numbers 13, Yahweh was hot and wanted to destroy Israel by pestilence. Moses pleaded on Israel's behalf. I'm going to read this out of the RSB. Numbers 13, 1. Yahweh spoke unto Moses, saying, send you men that may search the land of Canaan, which I give unto the children of Israel, of every tribe, of their fathers. You shall send a man, every one, a ruler among them. And Moses, by the commandment of Yahweh, sent them from the wilderness of Paran, and all these men were heads of the children of Israel. So he sends 12 men in to spy out the land. Moses sent them to spy out, verse 17, of Canaan, and said unto them, get you up this way southward and go up into the mountain and see the land, what is, you know, lies ahead, and the people that dwells there, whether they be strong or weak, few or many. And what the land is that they dwell in, whether it be good or bad, and what cities be that they dwell in, whether in tents or in strongholds. He goes on, he says, I want a complete report of what we need to face here shortly. I want to know all about it. So they went up, verse 21, and they searched the land from the wilderness of Zin unto Rehob, as men come to Hamath. And as they ascended by the south and came unto Hebron, where, you know, anyway, we dropped down there. So verse 25, they returned from searching of the land after the 40 days. 40 is a time of testing, of trial. And they went in and came to Moses and Aaron and to all the congregation of the children of Israel unto the wilderness of Paran. And what did they say? What was their report? What did they tell them? Well, we came into the land you sent us, and surely it does flow with milk and honey. It's great land. Fertile. Can grow anything. This is the fruit of it. They brought back lots of fruit. Kind of like, you know, when they spied out the Louisiana Purchase, of which we in this state were a great part of. And they came back with stuff for Jefferson and everything to show him what they had done, what they had found. But we got a problem. The people are strong. Man, you're not going to be able to get past. You might as well just hang it up. They live in very big walled cities. And we saw the children of Anak there, and they're like giants. And oh, man. So I think we better just hang it up. Go somewhere else. Maybe Yahweh has a different plan, different promised land. Caleb, verse 30, stilled the people before Moses and said, let us go up at once and possess it, for we are well able to overcome it. But the men that went up with him said, we be not able to go up against the people, for they are stronger than we. They brought up an evil report. They couldn't do it. And so we saw giants, verse 33, which, you know, there's no way. We were like grasshoppers in their sight. And so what happened? The people heard it. Oh, good night. Here goes. Everybody crying. Oh, man, now we're really doomed. Gloom and doom. All the children of Israel murmured. And the whole congregation said, if only we had just died in Egypt. the same as coming out here and dying. We're not going to make it anyway. Wherefore has Yahweh brought us out to do this? So it's all, you know, we aren't going to get anywhere. Yahweh was hot. He wanted to destroy them by pestilence. Yahweh pleaded. Or I should say Moses pleaded on the people's behalf. Please, Yahweh, don't do it. Don't destroy them. From the first great victory of Joshua against the Canaanites, Yahweh gives us some powerful lessons. Because Joshua said, no problem. Caleb said, no problem. Let's go. We'll just go right in there. We learn, don't indulge in self-pity. Trust Yahweh no matter how difficult the situation seems to be. Don't dispute him. Don't challenge him. If he says go, don't you think he has the ability to make it happen? Do we, you know, question his management and our affairs? Where is the faith? And it all boils down to that. Second, don't look for someone else to blame for your problems. Joshua didn't do like the rest of Israel. Oh, Moses, now look what you've done. Amalek is going to wipe us out. How long could you put up with such grumbling people if you were Yahweh? What about poor Moses, always getting the brunt of their discontent? How much can one person take? Have things really changed in people's nature? I don't think we're too much different. You're going to have dark days, but, you know, that's part of it. That's part of life. We grow by the things that we have to work against. They're Yahweh's arrangement. We have to trust in him. That's why we have them, so we can trust in him. He can bring a blessing even out of the worst desert wasteland. Third lesson, we will always have to battle our worst enemy, our own doubts, our old nature, our selfish natural selves that will produce doubt and even fear if we lose faith in Yahweh. Will we defeat ourselves, brethren? Whatever we find Yahweh's word tells us to do, do it at once. That's the fourth lesson. Just do it. No excuses, no apologies. Like the man who said at my first feast, if that's what the Bible says, that's what I'm going to do. If that's the attitude we should have, then we would please Yahweh. That's the attitude Joshua had. Just do it. Let's go. If Yahweh says to do something or not do something, just obey. Give Hasatan the heave-o and just do it. So Israel moves across the desert to Mount Sinai. In Exodus chapter 24, verse 12, Yahweh called Moses to this thunderous, craggy mountain to receive his laws. Actually, of course, I'm backing up a little bit. But out of the millions of Israelites, Moses chose Joshua to go with him. Verse 13, Moses rose up and his minister Joshua, and Moses went up into the Mount of Elohim. He recognized a good man when he saw it. I'm taking Joshua with me. I need some faith to even bolster my faith. And this man's got it. I'll take him with me. For 40 days and 40 dreadful nights, there was no sign of the two men. They just kind of disappeared into the smoke of the mountain. Just that thundering, smoldering, shaky mountain. The fire at night, no sign of Moses and Joshua. So here, Moses is in total isolation, even from Joshua. Communing with Yahweh, Joshua doesn't know where he's gone. Still there, just waiting. He knew it was his duty to stay there and wait. It was a measure of the man's great spiritual tenacity and fortitude. He didn't despair or panic like Israel did. Not knowing what happened to Moses, 40 days of patient waiting. I wonder what he ate. Apparently, he fasted too. Not giving up to any impulse to join the people down at the base of the mountain. Maybe I'll just go back. I don't know what's happened to Moses, but I can't sit up here all this time. But he remembered the instructions to go. Stay with me. Be with me up here in the mountain. He had nothing but his durable confidence that Yahweh would answer any need he had to sustain him. He was totally loyal, like a patient son, like Yahweh's own son. No wonder their names are the same. patiently doing what Yahweh commanded him to do, come and give his life, and did everything he could to make it happen, to be a witness on this earth of Yahweh himself. This is what our Savior did. This is what this man was like. In these quiet interludes of life, when we're subtly tested, are we the same? Do we not give up? Do we stand fast? Are we going to remain on the mountain? Will we hang in there when doubts arise and being alone begin to question, uh-oh, did I make the right decision? When there's no one else to fellowship with? I get great encouragement. We hear from prisoners, and I remember one telling us how he's all alone. There's no other believers here in this whole institution. I'm locked up by myself. I have no one else to fellowship with. Can you send me some information? And then he goes on to encourage us. Amazing, isn't it? Encourage us. What is the caliber of our character? Can we remain strong and faithful during times of isolation and stress and tests? We're apart from friends and associates and even family. Even when we seem forgotten for a while. The tactics of armies is to divide and conquer. I was watching a presentation about the Civil War and about how sometimes the biggest errors that were made were done by the leaders because they figured one thing and something happened just the opposite. And, you know, if they'd just done this, they could have been victorious, but they didn't. And the enemy got in and divided them up and defeated them. That's the tactic, to divide and conquer. You know, wolves will do that. They'll see a herd of whatever, animals some type, and they'll split off one or two away from the crowd so there's no defense there. That's what the adversary does to Yahweh's people sometimes. Gets them alone, gets them to wondering, gets them to question, to wonder, is this really the right way? We don't have the regular fellowship. It's so important, brethren, to have regular fellowship, to be strong. You have to have it. Joshua remained unshakable. His fellow Israelites camped at the base of the mountain. They couldn't do it. They were, I guess, feeding on each other's fears, on each other's lack of faith, and pretty soon it just spread throughout the whole camp. And so it got rough down below. Exodus 32:1, after waiting a few days, Israel just gave up. Forget Moses, let's have a party. And when the people saw that Moses delayed to come down out of the mount, the people gathered themselves together unto Aaron and said unto him, up, let's make us Elohim, which shall go before us. For as for this Moses, the man that brought us out of the land of Egypt, we know not what has become of him. Let's just do our own thing. Some catastrophe must have befallen Moses and Joshua. Again, no faith in Yahweh. Yahweh called Moses up for Pete's sake. Moses was in his very hands and they couldn't wait. They couldn't remain strong. They started to have doubts. Where is their faith? Romans 8:31. What shall we then say to these things? If Elohim be for us, who can be against us? So Paul said, no problem. If Yahweh's with us, what are you worried about? So let's make a substitute mighty one of our own, something we can see and touch, and forget Yahweh. We'll make this idol into our own image. A mighty one that has no demands on us, no Sabbath to keep, no clean foods to eat. In fact, we can eat anything that slithers or crawls from under a rock or sits on the floor of the ocean and eats up all the carrion that falls down from the top. We can just eat all of that, just have a ball, whatever we want to, you know, decide what's food, we'll decide. No feast to add to our lives, no sin to worry about. This golden calf, just dumb, stupid thing, just looks at us and we can make up our own worship. You know, a good article I think sometime would be titled The Golden Calf of Popular Worship, because that's not far different from what we see today. Same thing Israel did. reborn today in popular worship. Make your own worship to please yourself. And then argue vehemently against Yahweh's commands. That's what they did in Israel. Exodus 32:2. Missed one. Let's go to Aaron the high priest had the responsibility of determining worship, just as we see today among the leadership. Just as with Israel, they do whatever the people want. Verse 2 of Exodus 32. Aaron said unto them, "Break off the golden earrings which are in the ears of your wives, of your sons, your daughters, and bring them to me." And all the people broke off the golden earrings which were in their ears and brought them unto Aaron. And they received them at their hand and fashioned it with a graving tool after he melted it all down. Keep that in mind because we're going to see something else in a minute. He had the responsibility and he dropped the ball. In verse 5, "And when Aaron saw it, he built an altar before it and made a proclamation and said, 'Tomorrow is a feast to Yahweh.'" See, it wasn't that they thought this was a new deity, but this was now our representation of Yahweh. "And they rose up early in the morning and offered burnt offerings and brought peace offerings. And the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. Yahweh said unto Moses, 'Get down, for my people, which you brought out of the land of Egypt, have corrupted themselves.'" Corrupted themselves. "They have turned aside quickly out of the way which I commanded them. They have made them a molten calf and have worshipped it and have sacrificed thereunto and said, 'These be your Elohim of Israel, which brought you out of the land of Egypt.'" Moses heard Yahweh say, "I have seen this people, and behold, it is a stiff-necked people. Now, therefore, let me alone, that my wrath may grow hot against them, that they might be consumed, and I'll make you a great nation." "I'll start over with you, Moses. I've just about had enough. In fact, I have had enough. They've actually turned away from me." Moses argued, says, "Well, yeah, but what are the Egyptians going to say? They're going to say, 'Hey, you brought them out to kill them.'" Yahweh repented of the evil he thought to do unto his people. Moses turned and went down from the mountain. The two tablets of the testimony were in his hand. They're written on both sides, and one side on the other were they written, and the tablets were the work of Elohim. The writing was the writing of Elohim graven upon the tablets. And when Joshua heard the noise of the people as they shouted, he said unto Moses, now listen to this. He heard the shouting of the people. But what did he think about it? He says, "There is a noise of war in the camp." War. He recognized it not as partying, but as war against Yahweh. That's his interpretation. And he said, "It is not the voice of them that shout for mastery, neither is the voice of them that cry for being overcome, but the noise of them that sing do I hear." But he called it war. Yep, they were in war against Yahweh for sure. Joshua's perspective, his reaction, shows the character of this man. He knew what it was all about. And his reply gives insight into the depths of his spiritual being. He knew that now there was war between the people and Yahweh. Now they've crossed the line. He was in sync with the mind of Yahweh. He could sense the profound spiritual impact of what they were doing, what was happening. The people have been redeemed from the sins of Egypt, miraculously saved from the oppression of their taskmasters. And now, like a dog returning to its vomit, they betrayed Yahweh's trust from oppression and bondage to a great worldly empire. And now, like a dog going back, they return to the very evils of the world that Yahweh had taken them from. Isn't that something? Complete turnaround. Moses finally saw it for himself and he was just livid. He threw those tablets down, indicating that all the laws have been broken. Because, you know, if you break the first one, you basically have broke all the other laws. You can't keep a law to another mighty one, even if it's a law in the commandment. If it's done to the wrong mighty one, you've broken it. There isn't a single law that you can keep if you're keeping it to some other mighty one, some other Elohim, if you're not keeping it for Yahweh. So all of them are broken. You only have to violate the very first. I am Yahweh. You honor me. You worship me. Moses challenges his brother Aaron and was enraged by all the excuses he heard. The people made me do it. Remember we just read that he fashioned it? But what does he say? I threw the gold in and out came this calf automatically. The Levites gathered around Moses and he instructed them to kill their brothers, friends, and neighbors. Very tough thing to have to do. 3,000 rebellious Israelites lost their lives at the hands of their own people, the Levites, because these people did not sin against Yahweh. Besides our own carnal pulls, those closest to us represent our greatest obstacle if they're not believers. The greatest obstacle to our faith and obedience to Yahweh, because they exert the most influence on us. That's a powerful lesson. Once the priests, the office we're striving for in the coming kingdom, followed Yahweh at the cost of their very kin, and Yahweh says, you have been blessed because you have stood firm. One solution, I guess, would be to teach our family, teach our relatives Yahweh's word. That would certainly be the right and wonderful thing to happen. A glorious thing to happen. Use the opportunity of your Sabbath keeping to give them a lesson. The seventh day has always been the biblical Sabbath, you can say. It was the, quote, church that made the switch. Have you ever thought about that? It's easily proved. No, I never have. All right, let's get into the Bible. I'll show you. In only 40 days, representing the time of trial and testing, Israel had completely corrupted themselves. They couldn't stand the test. Their trial was a disaster, so they made an idol to ease the path to their own religion. They violated Yahweh's very first commandment. So Moses begs mercy for the people. It came to pass on the morrow that Moses said unto the people, you have sinned a great sin, and now I will go up unto Yahweh, perhaps I shall make an atonement for your sin. Exodus 32:31, Moses returned unto Yahweh and said, oh, this people have sinned a great sin and have made them Elohim of gold. Yet now, if you will forgive their sin, he was an intermediary, and if not, blot me, I pray, out of your book, which you have written. Whew. Moses drew the line with Yahweh. He said, if you can't forgive them, then eliminate me. Powerful. Yahweh said unto Moses, whosoever has sinned against me, him I will blot out of my book. Therefore, now go, lead the people unto the place which I have spoken unto you. Behold, my angel shall go before you. Nevertheless, in the day when I visit, I will visit sin upon them. They're going to pay. I'll let them live, but they're going to pay. And Yahweh plagued the people because they made the calf which Aaron made. Joshua, he was faithful in all things. He was willing to be subservient to Moses and to Yahweh. He was not the kind that wanted a piece of the action. He didn't strive to be equal with Moses to help make the decisions. He just said, I will serve in whatever capacity I can. He was meek, he was modest, he was unassuming, he was content to be an aid, content to be in the state that he found himself in. And he demonstrated his faithfulness in everything. Isn't this Yahshua? Sure it is. This is our Savior. Faithful in small things, faithful in great things. He'd be chosen by Yahweh for great leadership and mighty victories that would overshadow his predecessors. And those nations of Canaan started falling like dominoes, starting with Jericho and all the others. Ammonites, Hittites, Jebusites, all of these people started in defeat against this onslaught that Yahweh was behind. And he had different ways of doing it. If you read about it, it's fascinating. Read the book of Joshua and how they overcame these people. It's really fascinating. They draw them out of the cities, like Ai, and then get behind them so that the Israelites, they would think they're in defeat or in retreat, I should say, and start chasing them. Then they would turn, and these people would turn around to go back. They got another line of Israelites coming at them, and the whole city would be wiped out. Yahweh had it planned that way. That's how one of the ways he destroyed these people. Showed Joshua how to do it. Joshua didn't have any training specifically for it, but he did what Yahweh showed him. This is the man who had the right stuff. This is a man who was the prototype of Yahshua the Messiah. Along with Caleb, he stood against the 10 others in faith, saying, "We can go into Canaan. Don't listen to the others." He defeated the fortified cities like Jericho. Amorites, Hittites, Jebusites, all defeated. He never looked for glory. He just kept doing Yahweh's work. Throughout this whole account, we also see the work of the adversary, trying to overthrow faith, trying to divide. How do you think Satan will work in these final days? Through nominal worship? No. That's already in darkness. No, it's going to be Yahweh's people. He's going to be the prize, the very future of Yahweh's family. That's the ones Satan's going to zero in on. He even works on destroying relationships with Yahweh. Revelation 12:10 says he's the accuser of the brethren, accuses them before Yahweh night and day. He's always saying, like he did in Job, "Oh, you just give them a little trial. They'll fall. They'll fold like a deck of cards." He even works to destroy you and me if he can. He's a master craftsman. He exploits your weaknesses. He uses your weaknesses as he did Israel's. What are your weaknesses? Well, each of us knows, and he knows them better than we know. Do you have envy? Satan's going to use that. Do you desire things, material things? Satan will use that. He will use it as well to tempt and overcome you. James chapter 4, verse 1. "From whence come wars and fightings among you? Come they not hence of your lusts that war in your members?" Doesn't it come from you? He says, "You lust and have not, you kill and desire to have. You cannot obtain, you fight and war, yet you have not, because you don't ask." You don't ask and put your faith in the right areas, in the right direction. "You ask and receive not, because you ask amiss, that you may consume it upon your lusts." He says in verse 4, "You adulterers and adulteresses, know you not that the friendship of the world is enmity, with Elohim? Whosoever therefore shall be a friend of the world is an enemy of Yahweh." Do you think that the scripture says in vain, "The spirit that dwells in us lust envy"? Don't you think that's part of your nature? But Yahweh gives more grace. Wherefore he says, "Elohim resists the proud, but gives grace to the humble." Those that, like Joshua, he gives grace to them who want to serve him. Do you have a hot temper, perhaps? Fly off the handle? Do you have hostility or anger? Satan's going to exploit it. He's going to try to destroy you with it, like a virus attacking the weakest points. And he attacks us because oftentimes we're not close in prayer to Yahweh. We lack study of his word. When our spiritual immune system is weakened by various things of the world, the pressures and the stress of this world coming into our lives, we need Yahweh's presence to bolster that strength that only he can give. He attacks and we get upset over little things. The Marthas around us, like Luke 10. I'm so worried about everything just right, you know, and not looking at the big picture. There's all sorts of ways we can be tempted. Selfish ambition. We lose our focus on what we really need to be doing. Uncontrolled emotions. We get uptight and upset about something. And it goes on and on and on. We can't get over it. Loss of spiritual fervency. Revelation 3:15 talks about that. lust of the flesh, the pride of life. There's so many obstacles out there, so many Canaanites to overcome. But Yahweh's going to have to help us, and He will, if we just put our faith in Him. It's not easy. No one said it's going to be easy. But anything worthwhile comes at a cost, comes at a price that we have to pay. 1 Peter 5, 8-9 says we have to be vigilant. We have to be watchful. We have to be aware of these things. You know, in that respect, we're no different in what the world suffers. We'll be tried by the same things the world is tried with. Only it's going to be harder. It's going to be deeper. It's going to be more often, I submit. And especially with graver consequences if we can't live up to it. Yahshua said in Luke 12:48, "For unto whomsoever much is given, of him shall much be required." Brethren, we've been given a priceless gift of knowledge of His truth. There isn't anything greater than understanding Yahweh and following Him in this world. There's nothing greater than that. Because of that, we're going to have to sometimes suffer the consequences of the adversary who would like to take it all away from us. But we can overcome. We can be Joshua's and saying, "Hey, look, we can do it. We can take it. If we truly are the work of Yahweh, if Israel was truly the people of Yahweh, then what we have to face is something we don't need to worry about. Yahweh's going to work it out. He's going to have His will done with us, with you and with me, if we remain faithful to Him. And if we aren't His, if we just give up, then we're just wasting our time anyway. We might as well go back to Egypt. Might as well just live by the world, go for the gusto, forget it. Because we don't really have any hope if we don't have Yahweh. I want to finish with Joshua chapter 24, the end of the book. Probably one of the most heartening of all the passages, I think. Because here we have the final summation of a man who lived through it all. Joshua 24. I want to look at verse 14. The end of the book. The end of his life. He says, "Now therefore, revere Yahweh and serve Him in sincerity and faithfulness. Put away the mighty ones that your ancestors served beyond the river and in Egypt." And by the way, I'm reading this out of the New Revised Standard. Put away those mighty ones of Egypt. Serve Yahweh. If you are unwilling to serve Yahweh, choose this day whom you will serve, whether the mighty ones of your ancestors served in the region beyond the river, or the deities of the Amorites in whose hand you are living. But as for me, I'm sorry, whose land you are living, but as for me and my household, we will serve Yahweh. That verse gives me a lot of confidence. You know, even though people will turn away from the truth, get angry when you tell them, say that's Old Testament, whatever arguments they use, say, "Well, as for me and my family, we're going to stick with it because it's my life. I'm working out my salvation, not yours. You can do what you want," just as Joshua says here. That's what you want out of life, then have at it. But we would live for a different kingdom. We'd live for a different purpose. He says, "Then the people answered," he writes, "far be it from us that we should forsake Yahweh to serve other mighty ones. For it is Yahweh our Elohim who brought us out and our ancestors from the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery, and did those great signs in our sight. He protected us along all the way that we were in, and among all the peoples through whom we have passed, and Yahweh drove out before us all the peoples of the Amorites who lived in the land. Therefore, we also will serve Yahweh, for He is our Elohim." Interesting thing Joshua says now. He says to the people, "You cannot serve Yahweh, for He is a holy Elohim. He is a jealous Elohim. He will not forgive your transgressions or your sins. If you forsake Yahweh and serve foreign mighty ones, then He will turn and do you harm and consume you after having done you good. You see, it's your choice. It's your choice, and Yahweh will do whatever you choose to have him do. Serve him, you'll prosper. Don't, and you're going to suffer, just as Israel did throughout, whenever they turned their backs on him. But they said, no, we're going to serve Yahweh. We want Yahweh. One of the few times they actually kept their word. They actually did. For a while. Then Joshua said to the people, you are witnesses against yourself that you have chosen Yahweh to serve him. And they said, we are witnesses. Talk about resolute. I think at this point, they really did truly mean what they said. Why? Because they had the leadership of an extraordinary individual that gave them the resolve and the desire. Having seen what he did, he must have been a remarkable man. You know, Joshua says there was none greater than John the Baptist, but I think this man here, you never once heard him complain, never once heard him question Yahweh. Even Moses did at one point, remember as we read? Never once did this man turn his back on Yahweh in any instant. And they could feel the power of his spirit, Yahweh's spirit working in him. He said, then put away the foreign mighty ones that are among you and incline your hearts to Yahweh, the Elohim of Israel. The people said to Joshua, Yahweh our Elohim, we will serve and we will obey. So Joshua made a covenant with the people that day and made statutes and ordinances for them at Shechem. He wrote these words in the book of the law of Elohim. And he took a large stone and set it up there under the oak in the sanctuary of Yahweh. And he said to the people, this is very interesting, sets up this big rock, this pillar or whatever. He says, now, you said it. This rock heard it. This rock's going to be around a long time. You better go with your promise. See, this stone shall be a witness against us, for it has heard all the words of Yahweh that he spoke unto us. Therefore, it shall be a witness against you if you deal falsely with your Elohim. So Joshua sent the people away to their inheritance. Verse 29. After these things, Joshua, son of Nun, the servant of Yahweh, died, being 110 years old, and they buried him in his own inheritance at Timnath-serah, which is in the hill country of Ephraim, north of Mount Gaash. What a fitting tribute to a man who, more than most, if not all, reflected our Savior. When they made a commitment to Yahweh, and they did serve, even after he was gone, they served Yahweh until those leaders around him, the priests and so forth, died out, then things eventually would change. But wow, what a testimony to a man who had the influence on so many people to make them want to serve Yahweh. It's rare. It's rare in Yahweh's word to see such a thing. And it's rare to have a Savior like Yahshua the Messiah who stands for us and overcomes the adversary ultimately so that we might have life everlasting. May we think of these things and may we remember the man Joshua and strive to be like him so that Yahweh would find us acceptable in his sight and worthy for his kingdom. May Yahweh bless you.